What's up, everybody? Another episode of Ripple Effect Podcast. I'm your host, Ricky Verandes. Today, we have a great podcast with one of the leading experts in the JFK, MLK, Robert Kennedy, and Malcolm X assassination, James DiEugenio. He is one of the most respected people in regards to these political assassinations. And today, we're going to focus on the MLK assassination with the anniversary of assassination being right around the corner in April, I believe April 4th. So, perfect time to have him on to talk about this. He's written three books on the JFK assassination. He's written, he was co-editor of the book called The Assassinations, which was a book about the deaths of all of those people I refer to, JFK, MLK, Robert Kennedy, and Malcolm X. And he also is the co-founder of two organizations that research these assassinations, one called the Citizens for the Truth About the Kennedy Assassination and the Coalition on Political Assassinations. So, really fun conversation on our YouTube channel, which you can find this podcast and all my podcasts, which is RV Theory 6, or you can just search the Ripple Effect Podcast and you'll find it. You'll find playlists with documentaries, and I do have some documentaries about some of these assassinations. So if you're interested in some thought-provoking documentaries, please check that out, and also subscribe to our YouTube channel, review our show, rate it, share it, do all that stuff. James also has a great website called KennedysandKing.com, which is a website dedicated to the assassination of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King. So please check that out. Check out his books on Amazon. As I always do in the show notes on our YouTube channel, I'll put links to our guests' social media sites and also their personal sites, their Twitter handle, all that stuff. So it makes it really easy for you to look more into our guests and connect with them if you'd like to. So I think that's it for now. Enjoy the show, and I'll see you guys in the next one. Thanks for being with me, Jim. I really appreciate your time. I've been a fan of yours for a long time. You've always been one of the best researchers when it came down to political assassinations like the one we're going to talk about today. And let's for some of my listeners who aren't familiar with your background, how you got involved with researching a lot of these assassinations that you research, how did you get involved in these topics, and why did you get involved?
Well, I was part of a magazine in the 90s called Probe Magazine, all right? And that journal was a bi-monthly journal that began after all the publicity about Oliver Stone's JFK movie came out. And we decided to cover all the assassinations of that period, not just the JFK case. And of course, one of them would have been the King case. Another one would have been the RFK case. And the other one, of course, would be Malcolm X. It just happened that during that time period, there happened to be actually a lot of activity in the other cases besides JFK. All right. And on the King case, of course, you had the attempt by William Pepper to reopen the King case in Memphis, you know, and that ended up being a civil trial. And you had another trial going on in Los Angeles, the Scott Enyart trial, to get his pictures back from the night of the RFK shooting. And so those are the kind of stories that we covered simply because hardly anybody else was covering them. For example, at the Scott Enyart trial, we were the only journal that had a reporter there every day of that trial. Dave Manning, not even the LA Times, they had a reporter there every single day. Well, at the attempt to reopen the King case by Bill Pepper, we covered that whole thing also. And then when James Earl Ray passed away, because the state of Tennessee would not allow him to be flown into Pittsburgh to get a liver transplant, there was a trial afterwards, a civil case, right? And we were the only journal that had a reporter there every day. In that proceeding, James Douglas was our guy on that one, all right? And that one was really bizarre because Court TV had originally agreed to broadcast that trial, all right? And at the last minute, they backed out, all right? Now, if you can believe it, the Memphis Commercial Appeal, which was and is the major newspaper in Memphis, which is where the trial took place, they didn't cover the trial. Their journalist on the King case would wait for our guy, Jim Douglas, to come out every day, and he would have to then inform him of what happened in court that day. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say is we had to do this for the simple matter nobody else was going to do it. All right? And so that's what we were about at that time. And, you know, if you want to see the Probe CD, it's for sale on our website, the KennedysandKing.com website. All right? And it's about 7 years of this stuff that everybody else has ignored. Yeah. All right? So that's how I got started in this. And then today we have the website I just mentioned, Kennedys and King, and I published about three books. So that's how I got involved with this, and that's what I'm doing right now.
Yeah, I think that's always an amazing part of all this is how little publicity some of these court cases got. And even when they, the 99 court case, I mean, just very little media talking about it, and it really just seems like a media blackout on a lot of this stuff. In regards to the MLK assassination, so for people who are listening, like, let's talk about what the official story is, and then let's talk about what parts of the official story start breaking down.
Well, the official story or the official verdict is that a guy named James Earl Ray shot King in the first week of April, 1968, in Memphis. And this was when King was coming out to the balcony of the motel that he was staying at the time. All right. And Ray is supposed to be in this boarding house across the street. All right. And with one shot, he kills King. And then he escapes, gets all the way through the United States into Canada, goes to England, takes a trip to Lisbon, Portugal. And then finally, he's apprehended approximately about a month later, okay, at Heathrow Airport. All right. He comes back, all right, and this is where the story gets a little out there, because his original assigned attorneys, father and son team, Arthur Haynes and his son, had every intention of going to trial on the case. And they had already been approached by the prosecution and offered a plea bargain. All right? In other words, the prosecution did not want to go to trial. All right? And so they were going to say, okay, let's have a deal. He does 10 to 12 years or something like that, you know, for murdering this great civil rights leader, which indicates, of course, that they probably didn't have a very good case, or at least they didn't think they had a very good case. All right. Whereas Haynes and his son, Arthur Haynes and his son, they didn't even want to settle for that. Okay, they were determined to go to trial because that's how good of a case they thought that they had. All right, and, you know, that Ray didn't do it. All right, and so at this point, James Earl Ray made a very bad mistake. All right, and it had a tremendous impact on the history of this case and his life, because he wanted to take the stand. Now, this is my latest understanding of this issue, which is kind of a complex issue, how the Haynes and his son left the case, all right, and a new lawyer, Percy Foreman, entered the case, all right? From what I understand, King, during the trial, the trial over King's murder, Ray wanted to take the stand on his own behalf. Most lawyers don't want their clients to take the stand because they figure, you know, one mistake, all right, and if it's a predetermined case, and in this case, of course, the publicity had whipped up to such a point that everybody thought Ray had done it, you know, and you could jeopardize the whole case, all right? Well, for that reason, Ray allowed this guy, Percy Foreman, a very high-profile Houston criminal attorney, to come into the prison and go ahead and become his lawyer, replacing Haynes. Now, the way that that was done is controversial to begin with, all right, because it's pretty obvious that Foreman lied about how he entered the case. All right. He said that somebody had written him a letter from the Ray camp, okay, while he was away from town, etc. Well, nobody's ever been able to find this letter. All right. And it looks like Foreman wanted to enter the case, all right, more than James Earl Ray and his brother wanted him to replace Haynes. All right. And so when Foreman entered the case, this was the deal for Ray's defense. A very famous author, William Bradford Huey, was going to finance Ray's defense in return for magazine and book rights to the case. And in fact, he'd already written a couple of very high-profile Look magazine articles on the case, right, and been paid very well for that, all right? So Foreman went in, and he had the agreements rewritten, and because, like I said, Huey was a very high-profile author, Foreman was going to get something like $100,000 to defend, which back then, I mean, it's probably like over $500,000 today, you know. So even for a high-profile criminal attorney, that's a lot of money. All right, and so he had the deal rewritten, all right, and that's how he entered the case. Now, at the beginning of this, from everything I've been able to find out, Foreman was going to go ahead and really do his best to try and get his client off. Well, after a couple of weeks, it became very clear that that was changed. And Foreman didn't offer a defense. And in fact, if you listen to Arthur Haynes, he spent like less than an hour going through his files on the case. And he actually went to a public defender and got the public defender to do all the legwork. And then he intimidated, all right, James Earl Ray and his brother to go ahead and plead guilty, all right, in return for not getting the electric chair. Now, if that's not bad enough, there's a very interesting book that was published a few years ago all right, called The Martin Luther King Congressional Cover-Up by a guy named John Avery Emerson. And he discovered something that somehow it escaped both investigations and also the authors on this case. It turns out that during the what Ray had to do now that he had been thrown overboard by Foreman, he had to sit through a recitation of the evidence against him by the prosecutor, all right? And then the judge asked him this question: has any pressure of any kind by anyone in any way been used on you to get you to plead guilty? All right? Now, in the original transcript, Ray answers that question by saying, no, no one in any way. Well, it turns out that this guy found the actual recording, all right, that took place in the court that day. And that is not what Ray said. Ray replied to the question with a question. He said, now, what did you say? In other words, he never answered the question. All right, and so the judge kind of just stepped over that answer, all right, and just went ahead with the proceeding. Now it's very interesting because the author John Avery Emerson found out that this is a very obvious substitution in the transcript because it's done in a different type. All right, so the fact that this was forged really kind of blew Ray's chances to have a good appeal, because obviously that's a very important question. Has anybody pressured you to get you to plead guilty? You know, it's a very strong grounds for an appeal if it's true, if somebody did. So if he did never answer the question, that could have been brought up on appeal. But of course, because everything was stacked against him, and because the transcript was forged, we didn't find out about this until this dedicated author actually uncovered it a few years ago. All right. Now, what makes this, I know it's hard to believe it gets worse than this, but it does get worse than this. Evidently, the judge in the case, Preston Battle, had second thoughts about this, and Ray wrote him a letter after Foreman left the case requesting that he get a new trial, all right, wanting to talk to him about the circumstances that now, you know, ask him, he's now asking to get a new trial. Well, if you can believe it, the judge died when he was replying to that letter, because he had it on his desk when he had a heart attack, all right? Now, under normal circumstances, Tennessee law, which of course is where the case took place, you know, you're supposed to be granted an automatic appeal if the judge passes away in the process of deciding your appeal in the case. Well, again, that didn't happen in this case. And when all the brouhaha hit in the 90s, with Pepper trying to reopen the case, they actually changed the law. All right? So that would not be the case anymore. That's how bad. So when you ask me, you know, when did the thing start going awry? Well, it started going awry when Percy Foreman entered the King case and did not give any kind of real defense to his client. That's when the King Ray case started really getting out of whack. All right. Now there's all kinds of other factors, which I'm sure you're aware of some of them, right? Which would have impacted a new trial. For instance, the way they got Ray back from England was very underhanded and very unfair. They ended up using the testimony of a very questionable witness, a guy named Charles Stevens, who was allegedly in the boarding house and saw Ray Lee. Now, how about this one? The boarding house, Bessie's boarding house, was so low class, okay, that the rooms didn't have bathrooms. There was a communal bathroom, you know, on the floor. And we're supposed to believe that Ray used this communal bathroom standing on the rim of a bathtub, okay, peering out a window to go ahead and take the shot that killed King. Yeah, and so in other words, you wouldn't know if anybody's standing outside waiting in line. You know, why would you do something like that without knowing that somebody's going to see you when you leave? All right? Okay? And so they got this guy named Charlie Stevens to say that it was Ray that he saw leaving the bathroom on that floor. Well, this is how desperate the city of Memphis was. It turns out Charlie Stevens was dead drunk at the time. And they had the testimony of the taxi driver who was there to pick him up, you know, who said he could barely stand up. All right? You know, that would have attested to that fact. His girlfriend, or I think she was actually his common-law wife, Grace Stevens, was not dead drunk. But the problem is, she would not identify Ray. She didn't think that it was him. So what did they do to her? They locked her up in a sanitarium, you know, for a very long time. So nobody would get to her. And it wasn't until Mark Lane got on the King case in the 70s, the early 70s, excuse me, mid-70s, you know, that he actually found out where she was and got her out. All right? That's how bad this case went awry, you know, right at the beginning. All right, so that gives you a general background. Then, of course, Ray, because Foreman had thrown him overboard and then Battle died, you know, was in prison for the rest of his life. Okay? And there was an attempt, a very popular and publicized attempt by William Pepper to try and get the case reopened in the 1990s with a judge named Judge Joe Brown, you know, who then later on became famous by having a television show. And so that's when the King case actually got a lot of attention, you know, on TV, newspapers, magazines, etc., because Pepper actually moved in court to do a test firing of the rifle, all right, to see if the bullet in question actually could have come from that rifle. There's always been a question about this. The alleged rifle in evidence is something called a Game Master, all right? The problem with that particular rifle is that the place where Ray purchased it did not have something called a collimator. That's a machine that is used to sight in the rifle. In other words, when you go to put the sight on the rifle, you have to make sure it's perfectly lined up with the barrel of the rifle, all right? There's two ways you can do this. One is by doing it manually. You do it on a target range, all right? And it usually takes about three or four shots to sight it in properly, or else it's going to be off to the left or off to the right, all right? And so that particular rifle, you couldn't do it manually. You had to have the collimator machine. Except the supply house where he bought the rifle at didn't have it. So in other words, Ray was at best an average shot, you know, so and on top of that, he's got a rifle that's not sighted in properly, right? So that's why there's always been this question about whether the fatal shot, and it was only one shot, that killed King, you know, was fired by James Earl Ray. And that's one of the things that came out, you know, during the motions by Pepper to try and get a new trial. You know, namely, that it's very unlikely that somebody like Ray could have fired one shot and hit King and struck him fatally like that. All right. There's another problem, of course, is that the bullet that was sent from Memphis to the FBI ended up being cut up into fragments. It was reportedly a whole projectile, you know, that was removed from King's body, all right? But it ended up, according to the FBI, for whatever reason, it was cut up in pieces after, which, of course, means it's very, very hard to inspect, you know, for forensic purposes, okay? Also, and this is similarity with the John F. Kennedy case, the autopsy did not dissect the wound, all right, which means, of course, you track the bullet path through the body, and then that gives you a very good idea of the path that the bullet took, and it will probably give you a good idea of where it originated from, all right? Well, that didn't happen in the King case, all right? And finally, the reason that Pepper had a problem with the FBI ballistics report about matching the bullet to the rifle was that the report said that there was supposedly a groove in the barrel of the rifle, which they did not understand if it came from the bullet or if it had pre-existed, all right? And so therefore they couldn't find conclusively, you know, whether or not the bullet matched a rifle. Well, in court, Pepper proposed to use a liquid electrolysis solution to clean out the barrel without damaging the barrel. And so therefore, you could have then decided whether or not the groove was caused by the bullet or not caused by the bullet, and then tested whether or not, you know, the bullet came from that rifle. Well, it was at that point, it was at that point that all Hades broke loose in Memphis, and Judge Joe Brown was removed from the case, all right? And once Judge Joe Brown was forcibly removed from the case, then any hope that Ray was going to get a new trial went up in smoke, all right? And, of course, if you ask me, that was the objective, all right? Because once, if it came back that the bullet did not match the rifle, then clearly you either get a motion for a new trial or you just dismiss the charges. And for some reason, the state of Tennessee did not want to do that. And so Judge Joe Brown was removed from the case. And once he was removed, that was it for a reopening on criminal grounds. All right. Now, after that, what happened was that the King family decided to go ahead and file a lawsuit against a gentleman named Lloyd Jowers, right? Lloyd Jowers had, for whatever reason, gone public, I think this was around 1997, on an ABC special hosted by Sam Donaldson, by saying that he had been part of a conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. Right? He had been handed the rifle, right, and then disposed of the rifle afterwards. His place, which was kind of a luncheonette, was like downstairs from Bessie's boarding house, right? And he originally said that this was part of what appeared to be a CIA mafia plot, all right? And he only had a small role in it, but he's paid something like $100,000 to do it. And so that was the basis for the King family lawsuit, which took place, I think, in 99 in Memphis. And that's the one I said we were the only journal that covered it every day, you know. And then we, and then our author Jim Douglas went ahead and wrote it up for us, and it was the only really fair summary of that trial, which the King family won. The jury came back and essentially said that it was a conspiracy. They agree with William Pepper, right, and against the defendant Lloyd Jowers. By the way, that's the second time that Pepper won that case, because if you recall, there had been a mock trial for British television, all right, in which Pepper had been the defense attorney, and he had won that case also.
Yeah, that was in 97, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was a couple of years before the actual trial, you know. And by the way, that was a... I have to say, you know, I usually don't like these mock trial things, you know, but that one was actually pretty good because it kind of followed the rules of evidence of a real trial. They had a pretty big budget, all right, and the defendant, James Earl Ray, was actually allowed to take the stand, all right, and it went on for like a 21 days, which of course they cut down for TV. But it was a really serious kind of an affair, you know, much better than the later one with Vincent Bugliosi and Jerry Spence on the King on the Kennedy case. But yeah, that was actually a pretty good production. So in other words, Bill Pepper won this case twice.
Yeah.
All right. Once in a mock trial and once in a civil trial, and they deliberately deprived him of the right to actually run a criminal trial. You know, in my opinion, he would have been at 3 for 3. All right. So that's generally the outline of what the King case has been about. You know, and it's very unfortunate, you know, that Ray was not allowed to, you know, to get that grant to get a liver transplant, because he probably would have stayed alive, you know, for any kind of a trial. You know, but he passed away in prison, right, before that was allowed to happen. There's so many other questions about this case. I mean, you could literally go on and on and on. It doesn't get the publicity that the JFK case does, you know, for obvious reasons, you know, like John F. Kennedy was a president and Martin Luther King wasn't. You know,
but I think the Zapruder film is a big part of that, too. I think the fact that people got to see the actual murder and assassination on film, I think that, you know, that's probably one of the reasons why it's a little more popular, too, because I think so many people are intrigued with that video and analyzing it. And the fact that you can actually see it done in broad daylight, it blows, you know, my mind, that the fact that, you know, there is a video that people can just go on YouTube right now and see the president get shot. You know, and assassinated. And I have nieces and nephews and our cousins and stuff that are younger than me. And, you know, I remember talking about the JFK assassination, and I mentioned that. I'm like, hey, isn't it crazy that you can go on YouTube? And they're like, wait, that's on YouTube? And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, you can actually see the president get shot. And they're like, no way. And I remember, I mean, they're probably 14 or 15 or whatnot, but it's amazing how popular that footage is, the Zapruder film, in regards to people my age and older, but there's a younger generation coming up that doesn't even know it existed. They know about the JFK assassination, but haven't actually seen the footage. And so it's amazing how people know of these events, but there's so many details that people just aren't familiar with.
Mm. Yeah, you're right. The Zapruder film is another, you know, very unusual. There isn't anything like that in any of the other cases that I know of. So that's another thing that really gives it a higher profile.
But there's a lot of similarities between all these assassinations, and I know you're much more familiar with them than I am. But I mean, a lot of things from like who the lone assassins are. You know, I mean, even with the rifle, like the fact that they found the fingerprints on the rifle of James Earl Ray, and it was just like left out in the open, and you know, which was always, you know, another.
Oh yeah, that one. I think we should talk about that a minute.
Yes.
That's part of the official story. We're supposed to believe that after the shooting. Well, first of all, when Ray went into Bessie's boarding house, he's supposed to be wearing a sport coat, a white shirt, and a tie, which, of course, for that kind of place, would have immediately made a very highly visible profile for him, because nobody else dressed like that in a place like that. All right? Okay? And so then we're supposed to believe that he goes into this communal bathroom, not knowing if anybody's going to be waiting for him outside to use the bathroom. But then he packs these several things into a briefcase, runs down the stairs, and leaves the briefcase in front of this novelty store, and then escapes in a white Mustang. Now, as Mark Lane said when he became Ray's lawyer, if my client did that, he should be found not guilty by reason of insanity. You know?
Yeah.
Who the heck does something like that, you know, leaving, you know, several articles plus the weapon, you know, on this was kind of like the foyer of this called Kniep's novelty store. Well, see, this is one of the reasons that Haynes wanted to prosecute the case, because he had a statement from the owner of the store that that package was there at least 10 minutes before the shooting took place. All right? And so that would have been one of the, you know, one of the bulwarks that Haynes would have used in his defense of Ray. You know, that's really powerful evidence. Okay, when you're saying that that something was planted in order to frame your client. You know, but that's only one of the many, many things in which any competent attorney, you know, could have used. There's also the problem of why was King's room shifted, okay, at the Lorraine Motel? Are you aware of that?
I think I do remember running into that somewhere, but I'm not sure about the specifics.
See, the original room that was booked was inside the complex courtyard room. It would have faced a courtyard inside the motel. Somebody went to the Lorraine Motel and shifted the room to the second floor on the outside with a balcony. So in other words, what I'm saying is that if the room would have remained where it had been, the shooting could not have been performed, at least not in the outline that the way it happened. So that is very interesting that somebody went to the trouble of changing the room. All right, now, and by the way, I should also say this. That was not the motel that King usually stayed at. King usually stayed at the Holiday Inn, all right? But what had happened is that the FBI had sent out stories about a week in advance criticizing King for staying at what they called a white person's hotel instead of a black-owned hotel. And that's what caused him to shift to that hotel. So you have this combination of the FBI forcing him to go to this other motel, and then somebody going to the motel and changing the room. All right? All right, now, to kind of accompany that, all right, you also have the fact that King had a special detail of bodyguards when he went to Memphis, because I'm sure you're aware of why he came back to Memphis, right? It was a sanitation workers' strike,
yeah.
Right? And he had come down to try and mediate it, all right? Then there was a demonstration that broke up into vandalism and rioting, all right? And he decided that it made a very bad impression, you know, in the city. And so that's why he decided to come back. And he had a special detail of bodyguards for when he went to Memphis that were not, for some reason or another, were not ready and not accompanied him this time out. So let's just look at that. You got number one, you got the FBI forcing him to go to a different hotel. You have this bodyguard service, which is not going to be there. And then you have somebody going in and changing his room. Now, doesn't that look to most people like there might have been a little bit of planning that went into this thing?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing. Like, all these have such similarities. When you look at, like, the bodyguard thing, it reminds me of, like, the Secret Service agents that jumped off, you know, during the parade with JFK, you know, like how...
Yeah, right out of Love Field.
Yeah, very, very, very similar. You know, it's amazing just how many inconsistencies there are. And I mean, even with all his the alias, the names that he used, all the travel.
Oh yeah, that's another very interesting thing. I'm glad you brought that up. All right, here's this guy who had been nothing but a petty criminal. I think the biggest robbery he'd ever pulled off was like a $1,500 or something like that. You know, had a few odd jobs, etc. But when he's allegedly escaping from Memphis, he goes to Canada, all right? And it's something that I really, you know, in fact, the only way to express this is, let me read this from the book, The Assassinations. How could a small-time hood have access to four different aliases, all living within a five-mile radius in Toronto, the city he would eventually flee to after the murder, with all four men resembling Ray in height, weight, and coloring? And by the way, that's not the capper. The capper is this. Ray had never been to Toronto prior to the assassination. I mean, that's amazing. He has access to these four different people's identities, all right, that all live within a five-mile radius in the city of Toronto, and they all resemble him in some way, all right? He uses their names, but he had never been to the city prior to escaping after the assassination. I mean, that's just, you know, anybody in the CIA or somebody will tell you, you know, that's an absolutely stunning coincidence. And they probably don't think, only if you had access to somebody's computer database, you know, could you perform something like that. You just can't do something like that by leafing through newspapers. Okay.
Yeah, and
you know, especially to a city you've never been to before.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that is, there are just so many things that just don't make sense. And that's the thing. It kind of boggles my mind how, you know, the government and politicians and everybody, they try to celebrate MLK and you know, which they should, as a great hero and influential person that he is. But yet they all ignore the fact that, you know, the government had some hand in the cover up. They had some hand, you know, the FBI threatened him. And everybody knows well about the relationship between Hoover and MLK and how they didn't like each other, which is funny that the FBI ends up investigating the assassination after, which, you know, does anybody think that's going to be a good investigation? I mean, it again reminds me of JFK and Alan Dulles being put onto Warren Commission after being fired. You know,
right.
It is weird. And the other thing too, like all the costs from the traveling. I mean, I was born in Portugal. I know that going to Portugal is not cheap. You know, and traveling to Europe is not cheap. And I mean, this guy is a petty criminal, and all of a sudden he has all this money to do all this traveling. Again, reminds me of Oswald, and people not asking the question like, hey, don't you think it's kind of weird that Oswald went to, you know, the Soviet Union during the height of the Cold War and the tensions and comes back with a Russian wife, like, and nobody asks any questions? Like, that's not weird, you know? So it's very similar with him doing all this traveling, you know, nobody asking where the money came from. All the weird things that happened with his lawyers, you know, like, you know, you talked about Percy Foreman and just motivating him to plead guilty. And I know there's some other stuff that happened with didn't he have an interview in Playboy magazine? He did a polygraph test
and there was a real controversy about that also. Okay, they kind of tricked him on that one. All right. Okay, and the guy who was doing the testing was, to put it mildly, not the most objective person. He was very upset. Ray was very upset about that whole thing. But what you just said about leaving the United States, going to Toronto, then going to England, then going to Lisbon, then coming back. Okay, here's another point that I think I'll read from the assassinations. If there was no conspiracy, why did a man meet Ray in Toronto after the murder and give him an envelope? That same day, Ray paid his rent and bought a plane ticket to London. When author Philip Melanson tracked the courier down to urge him to talk, he said, "Why go to Memphis and get a bullet in my head?" So in other words, somebody, while he was in Toronto, somebody slipped Ray an envelope. And there had to have been money in it, because that's the same day that he paid up his rent bill and then flew to England. So who was doing that and why? You know? So these are all the questions that, because there was never a trial, you know, and because they denied Ray a trial at the end and refused to fly him to Pittsburgh for a liver transplant, that we're never going to know the answers to. You know, and like I said, in all these cases, it's very frustrating that private citizens, like, for example, Phil Melanson, or like myself, you know, have to go ahead and try and find the answers to these questions, you know, when in fact it should have been, you know, the duty of the government or the duty of the court to do these kind of things. But that's why we have all of these mysteries, you know, and all of this confusion, you know, about these cases. It's not due to people like me or due to the late Philip Melanson. Okay, it's due to the fact that justice was never served in any sense of that word. And when you're talking about somebody of the stature of Martin Luther King, then that really means something for this country. Okay? Because when you lose a guy like that, you know, you don't replace someone like that. There's never been anybody since, you know, who took his place, you know, as a leader of the civil rights movement, you know, and accomplished anywhere near what he did for his race and for the United States. So that means a lot when you lose some, and when you lose four of them in 5 years, you know, then it's a disaster.
Yeah, and I mean, the CIA obviously thought that there was that the civil rights era and these leaders were a threat, because they were, I mean, this was a time period when they were basically, you know, spying on a lot of these, you know, these protesters and people in the civil rights era, and really saw them as almost like domestic terrorists, you know, in a sort. So it's amazing, you know, it's like that saying, you know, one person's freedom fighter is another person's terrorist. And counting on what side you're on, you know, there were freedom fighters, and from the, if you're African American and you're part of the civil rights era, and then if you're the government and you think these people are a threat to you, then you see them as terrorists, and that's how they justify their actions. And yeah, I mean, the whole story is just, it's so intriguing, and I feel like you said, it's been so under talked about. I mean, there's not a whole lot of great books out there that've gotten a lot of publicity. Any good books like yours and William Pepper, like it doesn't get a whole lot of attention. There's not a whole bunch of documentaries out that, you know, that really go in depth with all this. I mean, I know there's one or two I've seen, and they've kind of made William Pepper look a little conspiracy theorist like, and left out some really good evidence in it. And so it's sad, because a lot of people will celebrate, you know, MLK, but yet not know that the fact that there's this huge cover up with what really happened. And the government celebrates him now with us, but at that time, you know, they more or less, I think, had a hand in it. And so, from all the research you've done, what do you think is the piece of evidence that sticks out the most, that there was obviously a cover up? Also, I know William Pepper and other people have talked about, you know, him possibly not dying from the gunshot and dying, you know, at the hospital by other means. Do you also subscribe to that?
No, I disagree with them on that. As far as the most convincing piece of evidence, it's, I believe, you know, the fact that the weapon was not sighted in. Okay, you know, that, and the judge and the attorney, and, you know, all agreed that there's no way in the world that rifle could be accurate at that distance if it had not been machine sighted in. You know, that's a very, very compelling piece of evidence. And secondly, they were never able to match the bullet. You know, they were never able to positively say it wasn't part of it, okay? But they were never able to match the bullet to the rifle. You know, so the ballistics evidence in the King case, you know, added into every other thing, you know, well, just from the things I sketched out, it's pretty obvious why they didn't want to go to trial, you know, and why if the Haynes father and son team would have been there, you know, Ray, at the very least, would never have been in jail for the rest of his life. And the prosecution knew it. You know, and as I tried to say at the beginning of the show, you know, it's Percy Forman, you know, who was responsible for essentially, as we say today, you know, throwing James Earl Ray under the bus. I'm glad you brought in the thing about the CIA and military intelligence. You're absolutely right. See, I don't think people today understand what was going on in America at that time, all right? Because you had, at the same time, you had these huge civil rights demonstrations going on. You had these huge anti-war demonstrations going on, you know? And you were literally, and I'm not exaggerating very much at all, you know, it was not uncommon to get literally tens of thousands of people out into the streets for these demonstrations, you know? And so a lot of people in the government thought that, you know, these actually were a sign of, you know, unrest, rebellion, you know, and subversion. And so they actually went ahead and sanctioned these programs, you know, whereas the FBI, the CIA, and military intelligence would actually begin, you know, surveillance programs on people who all they were doing was exercising their right to dissent. And they did this on King. They actually placed a spy, you know, his photographer, you know, the FBI placed a spy, and this guy actually had something like 93 pages of reports, you know, on King, you know. And the military, there was the 113th Military Intelligence Group, you know, that went ahead and spied on things like the League of Women Voters, okay, at that time. And there was reportedly a military intelligence group in Memphis, you know, at the time of King's assassination. And according to some reports, they were actually working right out of the police department. All right. So these are the kind of things that were taking place at that time. You really had kind of, if I had to use a term, you know, a kind of quiet civil war going on, you know, between the people who wanted things changed and people who wanted them to stay the same. And that's one of the things I think they got figured in to this whole devastating 5 years in American history.
Yeah. Well, one of the programs, COINTELPRO, which I'm sure
right.
people are familiar with the term. You know, it's amazing that, you know, like I said, people that we look at as American historical figures were treated in such a way and possibly murdered in such a way. Now, there's a lot of people who believe it was FBI, CIA, mafia. I mean, do you have a theory on who do you think was the mastermind of the assassination?
You mean the King case?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I don't think there's any question that Raoul, who was commandeering Ray at the time, had to have been some kind of CIA guy. Or he had all the earmarks, you know, of working as a contract agent for the CIA. When you add in the other two factors, I would say that it was a combination of the CIA, the mafia, and the military intelligence. All right, that's what I think happened in that case.
And for people listening who don't know who Raoul is, I mean, he was basically the guy that James Earl Ray says told him to be at the hotel at that time, gave him the money, was having him do all these trips. And some people argue that he didn't even exist.
Well, it's really hard to believe he didn't exist, because when the FBI found Ray's car in Atlanta afterwards, okay, the first FBI agent there, a guy named Don Wilson, opened up the glove compartment, and there was a piece of paper in there that had Raoul's name on it. Okay? So, yeah, there definitely Raoul did exist. All right, and in addition to that written evidence, there's a number of witnesses, you know, that saw Ray with Raoul. All right, so yes, the guy was not a figment of anybody's imagination.
Yeah.
All right. He essentially, as you described, he was the guy, you know, giving Ray this money to do these missions with about the last year of his life. Okay, and the last one, of course, is the one we just described. He ordered him to go get this rifle, okay, at this Aeromean supply place, you know, a few miles, or actually about 20 miles from Memphis, all right? And so, and that was the ultimate thing that framed Ray, you know, for the actual assassination.
And there was no fingerprints in the hotel room, right? Because, I mean, basically the only place
that's correct.
Yeah. So the only place they found fingerprints on, coincidentally, was on the rifle itself.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so interesting. So, for people who are intrigued with this this assassination and the story and want to get more information, can you let them know about your books, about your websites, and any other projects?
Yeah, the Kennedy is called Kennedys and King is the website, and there you'll find several articles on the King case. All right. And in fact, there's one up there right now by me. All right. And our book, The Assassinations, is on the book I edited with Lisa Pease, is on all four of those cases, JFK, MLK, RFK, and Malcolm X. All right. And as you know, the RFK anniversary is coming up in a couple of months. All right.
Yeah, hopefully I'll have you on again.
On the actual King case, there's a book by Philip Melanson, which is a pretty good book. There's books by Bill Pepper. Orders to Kill is probably, I think, his best book on the King case. And there is a book by James Earl Ray himself, which I think is called The Martin Luther King Assassination. And that's a pretty good book.
Nice. Yeah. Isn't it weird that there hasn't been a good document? I don't even feel like there's been a good documentary on the JFK assassination that really goes into all the specific details. It's amazing how big these events are. And I mean, you just think even with the popularity of conspiracies, even if that was the incentive of creating a documentary, there really isn't a whole lot of great documentaries out there, because it is a little harder now in 2018 to get people to read, and sometimes it's easier to forward somebody a film for them to watch. But it does seem like there's a lack of really good documentary that's well researched.
Yeah, I agree with you. There's not a lot of good. Well, actually, there's not even that many good films about King, right? But there's a paucity of good documentaries on the King case. In fact, I think I've only seen one or two, and they were to me kind of average.
Yeah,
they really weren't that good. All right, so hopefully that'll change. And this is March 16th. Okay, so we've still got about 2.5 weeks. Hopefully something will be put on TV, before the actual anniversary, which is April 4th.
Yeah, well, I'm hoping to get this out before that, so we can, spark the conversation again and be a part of that. So, and hopefully I have you on again to talk about the RFK assassination. And I've told you about my idea of getting a bunch of JFK researchers together and doing a roundtable discussion. I think that'd be fun because there is a lack of in-depth research documentaries. That's kind of to kind of fill that empty spot of people who are really looking for answers. I'd love to get some people together. And I've had some researchers on my show that are well known for the JFK assassination, along with yourself. I know that I've talked to Russ Baker already. He's more than happy to do it. I just had Jefferson Morley on. I've had Lamar Waldron on a while ago on it. And the interesting thing is that everybody has a slightly different points of views on what exactly happened, who they think did it. And I think that having kind of a roundtable discussion would be, one, would be fun, and two, I think would maybe get to the bottom of some of these conflicting opinions on some of this stuff.
Okay.
I think it's anytime you can get a bunch of really well-researched, interesting minds like yourself on with some other people, hopefully it works out and everybody gets along and kind of keeps to the purpose of it, which is just trying to get some of the best information together in one place and do that. And knock on wood, I've been very lucky that I haven't had any shithead guests yet that I'm like, oh, I wish I didn't invite him on. So luckily everybody's been super nice and we can get a fun little discussion about it. And like I said, it'd be great because the thing is, the JFK assassination is so deep, and there's so many different rabbit holes you can go down. It'd be fun to kind of just gather all of some of the best evidence and best researchers and kind of, you know, kind of put out some of the best information. And really, more importantly, spark the conversation, because I think these things are under talked about and under researched, and there's not a whole lot of people out there like yourself that are really focused on these, really, I mean, some of the most important American historical events, you know, in history. And yet, you know, there's not a whole lot of spark, you know, every anniversary on this stuff. So, I mean, a lot of times it's more just remembering the person itself, remembering JFK and all the good, great right. things he did, and remembering MLK, but not about the assassination, you know, which I think is probably on purpose, you know, more than likely. So, but thanks again, Jim. I really appreciate your time. It was a pleasure talking to you. Like I said, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. And actually, this roundtable discussion, one of the things that kind of influenced me to want to do something like this, I don't know if you remember, a long time ago you did a kind of a roundtable discussion with Roger Stone and Sean Stone and
right,
you know, those guys, and that was a fun conversation. I've had all those guys on my show. Tyrell's been on, Sean's been on, Roger's been on, and it was a fun discussion. Mm-hmm. It was cool just to get a bunch of really interesting guys together like that, and just share, you know, ideas. It really was one a really fun discussion to listen to, because it was very casual, similar to my show, which I loved. You know, you guys, I mean, you could have put you know, some glasses of wine in front of you guys, or some, you know, some drinks, and put you in a bar setting, and it kind of felt like that type of conversation, and I love seeing that, you know, just the casual conversation and sharing each other's research and opinions and perspectives and theories and stuff. It was a really fun discussion. So if you guys haven't checked that out, go on YouTube. I'm sure, I think it was on the Buzzsaw show when they were still hosting that at the time, and you know, and check out that roundtable discussion. That was a really fun talk you guys had.
Okay.
But
thanks for the promo.
Yeah. no problem. Thanks, Jim. I really appreciate your time, and we'll keep in touch. And hopefully, you know, when the RFK anniversary comes around, when we get a little closer to that, I'll connect with you, and I'll keep you in touch, or keep you updated on the JFK roundtable discussion. Hopefully, we can get you involved also. And I'll also send you the links to the show once it's up and live.
Okay.
Great.
All right, thanks.
Hey, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.